Caitlin, quick little programming note right up top for you. We love to sound our best for you, but this time it's going to sound a little bit different, or at least it will on my side in the intro and the outro. The sound quality is not quite up to par as you are used to hearing on Simplify, but the conversation is excellent. So stay tuned for that. You'll grit through the intro where I sound a little fuzzy, and my apologies. Welcome to Simplify. I'm Caitlin Schiller.
I'm Benjamin Soler.
Good morning. Hello.
What's up?
Feeling bright-eyed and bushy-tailed? Put on some concealer under my eyes so I look particularly awake.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is a nice segue into today's guest, who is a little bit of a, I wouldn't say an anomaly, but she's a very different special guest. I think I keep saying that about all the guests lately, right? But our guest today, I'll just get into it, is Jessica DeFino. You might know of her from her Substack, honestly. That's probably the place where she is the most prevalent. She has this really wonderful Substack called The Unpublishable. She is also known as the woman the beauty industry fears most. And she does really intelligent, intellectual analyses and takedowns of beauty culture. Everything from makeup to aging and skincare to the Barbie movie and what it says about society today, which is all things that we're going to touch on in this interview. Jessica's really, really smart. She has a lot to say about this stuff. And I just really loved getting into it with her.
So why were you so excited to have her on here?
I was first exposed to her when I was sent by Maria, who is our wonderful production assistant, her post on the Barbie movie, or shortly before then. But the Barbie movie post was really the one that got me interested. I think I sent it to you too,
because
we talked about it. I have a lot of feelings about the Barbie movie. They're mostly not good, but I just thought that the way she treated it and the analyses and the observations she made were really smart. It was a fresh take that I hadn't seen before. So I thought, wow, this is a person who has a really interesting perspective and a lot of industry knowledge that she takes in interesting directions. So let's have her on.
Yeah. And then what should people listen to? Because we can get into more of the deets in the bookend, but what should people listen to in the interview?
I think that what people should really notice about this interview is the attention that Jessica gives to words and what we call things and what that ends up actually meaning for us and our cultural consciousness. I have a favorite of those things, but we'll talk about that at the end.
So. Oh, that's awesome. That's what I wanted to talk about also.
Awesome. All right. Well, we are aligned. So let's do it. Let's hear Jessica DeFino, and we'll be back at the bookend with book recommendations and more chat about this. Hi, Jessica. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
It is a delight. All right. So you have one of my favorite monikers that I've heard. But before we get to that, I will say that you are a reporter. You're a freelance beauty journalist. You have written for the New York Times and Vice and gosh, just so many of them. Currently, I believe you are writing The Guardian's beauty advice column, which is Ask Ugly. And yes. You have a wonderful Substack, which is how I discovered you, called The Unpublishable. And back to that really wonderful moniker, you're known as the woman the beauty industry fears the most. Why?
I love that moniker, too. That came to me via a profile in the Sunday Herald. And as soon as I read it, I was like, yep, that's going on all of my marketing. Yeah, I think it's pretty accurate because I report on the beauty industry pretty critically. Sometimes I will say I'm a pro-people, anti-product reporter, which means that I center people in my work, not the products that should fix them, change them, not the products they should buy. There's so much to beauty beyond industrialized beauty. And so that is the focus of my work, is trying to examine our attachment to industrialized beauty and how that attachment actually severs our relationship to actual beauty.
Oh, I love that. I want to dig in more there in just a minute, but sure. I wanted to ask you, how did you become her? How did you get there to be the woman the beauty industry fears the most?
Well, I think I started out as the exact opposite. I was a woman Ooh. The beauty industry really loved because I've been obsessed with beauty my entire life. I've spent so much time thinking about beauty, researching products, buying products, applying products. you know, beauty was kind of my entire life for a very long time. I think it culminated when I was hired to be an assistant editor on the Kardashian-Jenner official apps. And so that was kind of my first professional encounter with writing about beauty. And I was doing it with the most famous women in the world who were kind of known for, you know, setting a new beauty standard and sort of exploiting that standard for their own financial gain. And I loved the job at first. I was so excited to have it. I was really just like thrilled to have a platform like that, to work with people like that. And then it was just the deeper I got into the beauty industry, the more I saw the behind the scenes of how beauty standards are made and manufactured and mass produced and sold to consumers, I think the more disillusioned I became. Mm. And then at the same time, I think due to like the stress of it all and to using all of the free beauty products I was suddenly receiving, I was dealing with a lot of skin issues. And so in some way, it was sort of my own vanity that made me question, like, what are these products I'm actually putting on my skin? Why aren't they helping? Why do they seem to actually be hurting me? And what have I been missing in my knowledge of the skincare industry, which I thought was very vast, but turned out to be like a knowledge of products and not a knowledge of myself or my body or my skin. So those kind of like two paths kind of opened up at the same time for me to like explore beauty on a deeper level, like on the systemic industrial level and then on the personal, physical, like even spiritual level. And yeah, I fell into a rabbit hole that I've not climbed out of yet.
Yeah. Well, this sounds like it makes me think about, obviously, what did you say? It's the first article that went viral for you, the Slate article, Your Skin Doesn't Need Skincare.
No, it wasn't the first article that went viral, but it is probably like the closest to my heart and my own experience.
Okay.
Went viral.
Got it. All right. So in that essay article, you say, I mean, you make the argument, as it sounds, your skin doesn't need skincare, that your skin is self-sufficient. And how? Why? There are so many products out there. How can that be true if there's such a huge market for this stuff?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is where the skincare industry got its big ideas, is from the skin. Like, how do you think we came up with the ideas of cleansing, moisturizing, exfoliating, and healing? Like, those are actually what the skin is meant to do, and in healthy functioning skin will just do sort of on its own. So the skin has built-in mechanisms to self-cleanse, self-moisturize, self-exfoliate, self-heal, self-protect. A lot of these mechanisms come down to the function of the skin barrier and then the assistance of the skin microbiome, which is like an ecosystem of a trillion microorganisms that live in and on your skin and perform all these functions. And even if you look at, you know, some of the biggest ingredients in the beauty industry right now, in the skincare industry, hyaluronic acid, collagen, lactic acid, antioxidants. These are all things the body produces on its own.
Wow.
And that's why the skincare industry is like, oh, that's probably helpful for the skin. Let's try and put it in a bottle. What I found through my research is that the more we apply to the surface of our skin, the more we are disrupting the skin microbiome and degrading the skin barrier and making the skin less able to perform these inherent functions. It fosters like almost a sort of dependence on skincare products. And the more you take away, the more your skin can self-regulate. This is not to say that like nobody's skin needs support. Like just like any other organ, some of us might need help in the form of, you know, topical care or supplement or a lifestyle change. It functions like any other part of your body, but for the most part, pretty self-sufficient with the addition of sunscreen to make up for the environment of our modern times.
Right. So sunscreen is still important. That's good to know. It made me, when you said it fosters a dependency, it made me think about my experience with lip balm. And how if I don't have one in like every room of my house and every pocket, it's a bad day.
Yes. Lip balm is kind of like the gateway product for people to really start understanding like, oh, I've experienced that before. And this might actually be happening to the rest of my face too.
Oh, no. So then you said just like any other organ, some people do need support. And, you know, it could be you need some topical care. Maybe you need a supplement. How do you know if you're one of these people or if you're just layering stuff on top of your face that you absolutely don't need?
Yeah. I mean, the first step is to just like stop using skincare and see what happens.
What a terrifying thought.
I know. It is. Yeah. It's kind of a scary thing for a lot of us to do. And there is definitely for many people like a transition period where there are going to be some bumps in the road as you lessen the amount of products that you use. Like that's part of the skin re-regulating. So I always say, I mean, at least 2 weeks, that's been like dermatologist advice, and up to like a month, 28 days is the length of the skin's natural cycle. So that's how long it takes for a skin cell to be born in the lower basal layer of the skin, make its way toward the surface, and then naturally shed off in the process of desquamation, which is the skin's inherent exfoliation process. So 28 days is usually enough time to see what your skin is doing on its own and where it may need some support. And then the other thing I like to like throw in this conversation is I'm talking about like the function of the skin. I'm not talking about like aesthetic goals for the skin, of which there is a huge difference. Like I'm not interested in like the physical manipulation of the skin in service to a beauty standard that has nothing to do with health or functionality. Like, you know, glazed donut skin or like perfectly even, single tone, single texture skin. These are like not healthy goals. This is not how skin works. And so when I say don't use products, I don't mean like, oh, your skin's going to be perfect. I mean, your skin's going to be like human skin, which reacts to the world around it.
Right. Ooh, that just touched something within me, that this idea of your skin is an organ. It's a human thing that reacts to the world around it. So much of what we do is to keep ourselves from looking like we react to the world around us in any way, whether that's diet or exercise or just the masking that we do at work.
Right. I mean, I love that you bring up diet and exercise because this is one thing that I say a lot, and I think it helps it click for people. I frame skincare culture as dewy diet culture. Like there is so much in common between skincare culture and diet culture, and it really is the same values just applied to the face. So there is a lot to work through there.
Right. And the values, I don't even know where we start with the values there, but I feel like maybe this is veering into a good segue to your column about the Barbie movie, which was I forwarded to absolutely everybody who thinks on my email list. And
I loved.
I have very strong personal opinions about the Barbie movie, which are not positive. But so much of what your Substack on Barbie was about was beauty standards. In your opinion, what did the Barbie movie teach us about beauty standards in 2023?
Oh my gosh! I think Barbie movie taught us that they are still very important. And they are inextricably tied to your worth as a human being. It just said it in a nicer, more palatable way, very pop feminism, very choice feminism sort of way. I think my real issue with the Barbie movie requires analyzing the Barbie movie in conjunction with the Barbie movie marketing. That's where I really saw a huge disconnect. So for instance, I think we all know that the Barbie movie partnered with a ton of brands to create branded, you know, consumer goods in conjunction with the movie to as a promotion tool. And a lot of those products were beauty products. And many of the official Barbie branded beauty products that came out were in like directly challenged any sort of like easing up on beauty standards that was thrown into the movie. So for example, there is that scene in the Barbie movie where Barbie like sees an old woman in the real world and looks at her and starts crying. And she's like, you're so beautiful. She's looking at her wrinkles, like, you know, just a normal older woman. The Barbie movie collaborated with beauty brands to create anti-aging skincare. So the message is in movie land, in fake land, we can say aging is beautiful, but in the real world, the standard is the same as it's always been. Same with cellulite. Like cellulite was a huge plot point in the Barbie movie where when Barbie becomes human or she's on her journey to becoming human, she develops cellulite and it's horrifying to her. And at the end of the movie, it's something that she has to embrace if she wants the fullness and the richness of a human life. In reality, the Barbie movie partnered with a beauty brand to create a body lotion that addresses dimpled skin on your legs, which is cellulite. So again, it's like it's creating this nice little dream world where we can pretend that beauty standards don't matter and that they're being challenged. But in the material ways that the Barbie movie like touched actual human women, like physically through the products, the message is these standards still apply. We just can't say them out loud anymore. Everyone's expected to comply. Everyone's expected to buy the products and apply the products and change their bodies. But we just have to say that we accept ourselves now.
Yeah, I hear that. It also makes me think about this. And well, you just said before that beauty culture is like, it's Dewey diet culture. And it makes me think of the body positivity movement and how, you know, we're supposed to embrace our bodies at whatever size they are. And yet that's not actually really true. There's so much emphasis placed on, I'd say, presenting as though all bodies are beautiful, but we don't culturally really believe that, do we?
No. Nowhere else in our culture besides the feel-good language and a couple marketing campaigns is the idea that all bodies are worthy and valuable actually in place. You know, this is not a concept that's actually touched the real world in any way. There's a huge divide between the language we use and the products we use, I would say.
I have no answer for this. This is just me thinking out loud, but what does it even mean now that marketing language and good marketing campaigns are actually about accepting ourselves the way that we are, even while we're being sold things? Like, it seems so cynical and weird. I don't even know what to think about that anymore.
It is really cynical and weird. You know, it sort of reminds me of like, you know, the pharmaceutical commercials where the woman on the screen is like jumping for joy or like playing with her kids or like walking with a little bop in her step. And there's like happy music playing. And then the voiceover on the screen is like, warning, this drug may cause like diarrhea and death. And it's like there's this huge disconnect. And it's just like obvious that they're trying to put the happy sounding music and the beautiful visuals against this really upsetting message of how the medication may adversely affect you. That's beauty marketing to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems like that is everything marketing nowadays. Mm-hmm. It's also making me think about the Gabor and Daniel Amate book that came out pretty recently, The Myth of Normal.
Yes.
And how
I just downloaded the audiobook, but I haven't read it.
Did you? Okay, cool. Mm-hmm. I got to talk with Daniel a couple months ago, but this idea, basically, he was saying this idea of normal is incredibly damaging because there is no such thing. And normality is actually every shade of abnormality. And yet, we're still so attached to this idea that there is one kind of way to be. And it's just about selling and industrialization, and it frustrates me so much.
Yes. I mean, that makes me think specifically of the skincare industry and skincare marketing, where normal is considered a skin type.
Oh,
and
yes.
You look at all the other types that normal sits alongside, and it's supposed abnormality. So it's dry, oily, combination, normal, acne prone, sensitive. And like normal sits there as if to be normal is to have none of those issues. When in actuality, like all human skin, if it is functioning, will experience dryness, oiliness, sensitivity, and the occasional blemish. Like that's just what skin does. So yeah, this idea of normal as being perfect, it exists in the beauty industry in the same way.
Yeah, absolutely. What do you wish that people, I usually save this question until toward the end, but what do you wish that people knew about beauty culture? If there were one main thing that you wish they knew that they don't seem to, what would that thing be?
I think a good way to like sort of generalize it is that our culture uses the word beauty as a stand-in for a lot of different things in order to focus our attention and our, you know, money on the pursuit of physical beauty. But if you actually analyze the way that like beauty is being used, the word beauty, it functions as a stand-in for value and worth, most commonly for appearance, which I believe is just very different from beauty. I think we'd all be better off if we like flipped the wording of beauty industry to appearance industry, which is a more accurate description. So beauty functions as a stand-in for, you know, worth, value, for appearance, for power, for attraction and desire. And I think if we could just take the word beauty out of our vocabulary when we're talking about the beauty industry and really pinpoint what it's trying to sell us, and then just analyze it with common sense in our mind. Does physically adhering to this ideal actually deliver health? No. Does it actually deliver like value and worth? No. Does it actually deliver power? No, it's actually siphoning my time and money and resources. And I think if we can be more specific in our wording and our analysis of the beauty industry and take this like, you know, really beautiful, joyful concept of beauty out of it, I think we could see more clearly what we're up against here.
Yeah, I love that. And, you know, tinkering with your appearance can be really joyful, but I don't know. I mean, I think now I question when I put eyeliner on, am I doing this because I want to, or am I doing this because I feel obliged and like I have no eyes if I don't have this on?
Right. I mean, there are so many layers to it, and I never want to like tell somebody to just completely remove any sort of physical adornment from their lives just because. The way that I like to think about it in my own life is adornment versus manipulation. So there are so many ways where, to use your example, eyeliner can be adornment. I think of like Amy Winehouse. I think of like, you know, ancient Egyptians, how they used eyeliner to like communicate in ceremony with the gods. There was even a practical use to sort of like deflect sunlight. I love all of that. And then there's a way to use eyeliner, which is just manipulating your physical features to make your eyes look bigger, to disguise like a hooded eyelid, to change the shape of your eyes, to make them look rounder or more almond shape. These are more physical manipulations in service to a beauty standard. That's actually not serving anybody.
Except the people making money off of it.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So I do think that there are many, many ways to embrace beauty into our lives, even in a physical sense. That's more about adornment and expression versus manipulation or covering and concealing.
Yeah. Covering, concealing makes me think about foundation, which is a thing that I've never really had in my life. I was raised by a mother who didn't really do makeup. She was of age in the 80s, and she loved her blue eyeliner. So that was one thing she used. But foundation and face makeup was very mysterious to me. And when I lived in Spain for a while, about 15 years ago, I remember my Lothario of an Italian roommate having a woman over one night and complaining to me that she had gotten so much face makeup all over his sheets that he had to wash them. And he was very upset about it. And that really struck me. And it's a thing that I think about even today. Like, wow, she really thought that in order to go to bed with him and spend the night and for him to want her and for her to be acceptable, she had to keep that on. Maybe it wasn't all that thought out, but there was some kind of process there that told her that she needed that mask.
Right. I mean, I think that's very legitimate, especially when you think of the ways that beauty culture is passed down from generation to generation. Like, I think we see a lot more media about older generations where that was the norm. Like, I'm thinking of, have you ever watched The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, where she like does, her husband never sees her without makeup. Charlotte Tilbury is a big executive in the beauty industry. And I hope I'm not misspeaking. I don't think I am, but you know, everyone can double check me on this. I believe that she has said things about like not letting her husband ever see her without a full face of makeup. And I mean, I definitely did that with boyfriends or, you know, romantic encounters in my younger years where I would wear my full face of makeup to bed because it was so ingrained that this is what makes you desirable. It didn't make sense to me to remove a layer of desirability at the exact moment I wanted to be most desirable, like in somebody's bed, and at the same time say, actually, this might be a good place to like talk about, like, I sometimes like to reframe beauty behaviors as cosmetic coping mechanisms.
Ooh, please say more about that. Yes.
Yeah, I think, you know, beauty culture shows up in so many ways in the world, especially for women. And we are attempting to address real problems or to cope with real problems in society through cosmetics. And so, yeah, wearing makeup to bed is probably a good example of a cosmetic coping mechanism where you're coping with this idea, this anxiety, this pressure that has been conditioned into you that you are not desirable unless you are performing desirability. And in order to cope with that, we do the thing. We perform the desirability because it feels like this condition in society that is not going anywhere anytime soon, you know? So yeah, that's one way to look at it, I think.
And speaking of long-term implications and the long run, and as time goes by, I want to talk about Madonna for a minute. You have an article called Madonna's Face is Not Subversive. And can you talk about Madonna's face for people listening who have no idea what I'm talking about and why Madonna's face might be controversial? What's up with Madonna's face?
Right. So I think this article in particular and a lot of the backlash to Madonna and her face happened at this year's Grammy Awards, where Madonna, who was actually 64, looked noticeably different. You know, it was obvious that she had had surgery and that perhaps she was like still very inflamed from the surgery. Like she looked odd. And so there was a big backlash to this where it was, you know, one, Madonna's cosmetic work is bad. And then there was two, to say Madonna's cosmetic work is bad is being misogynist. And then there was, you know, Madonna's actually challenging the patriarchy by doing this. This is really subversive. And that's kind of what Madonna herself said, is she was challenging the patriarchy and misogyny with her plastic surgery. And yeah, it just the whole ordeal like stirred up a lot of discourse about aging gracefully, plastic surgery, what makes good surgery versus bad surgery. And yeah, I had a lot to say about it.
Yeah. And what do people mean generally when they say aging gracefully? It's one of those phrases that we hear all the time. And I think it could mean different things to different people. But generally, what do people are actually pointing to when they say that?
Yeah. Generally, when it's used in the beauty industry, aging gracefully is just a euphemism for anti-aging. If it wasn't, we would just call it aging. But what makes aging gracefully different is it implies that you are aging while still looking pretty youthful in a way that appears to be effortless. Of course, aging gracefully in the way that the beauty industry presents it is not effortless. It demands like an incredible amount of effort. And then it asks you to perform even more effort to like conceal the evidence of putting in effort. Like you're supposed to look as if this is just what you look like naturally, when in effect, you know, the version of aging gracefully that the beauty industry promotes requires lots of products, lots of procedures, sometimes surgery, lots and lots and lots of time and money to appear as if you're doing nothing and just staying young naturally.
So natural, indeed. Mm-hmm. It's like, I think that you also said this in this particular essay, but it's like so much women's work that needs to be accomplished, but accomplished in secrecy and silence, like having the perfect house, having well-behaved children, looking put together, getting to work on time, if, you know, that's the thing that you do, and just being pleasant all the time. And it's all a kind of labor.
Exactly. I mean, this is the construct of femininity. I think the effort that we put into it is evidence that it is a construct, but we're not allowed to like say that or think that. We're, in order to be, you know, a quote unquote good woman, you have to make it look as if your existence of performing womanhood, being a you know, a good wife, a good mother who's beautiful and stays youthful and, you know, is in shape. And how does she do it? How does she do it all? It's supposed to look effortless because our society really rewards sort of upholding the construct of femininity, concealing the construct of femininity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't really have much more to say to that. I think you said it all. But I want you to, or I would love it if you'd be willing to give people listening, give me a little bit of a preview into what else you have to say, because you're working on your first book. What are you going to be treating in that book?
So the book, the working title is called The Death of Beauty. And it's really exploring the concept of beauty as this almost sort of like spiritual concept. You know, I see it up there with beauty, freedom, truth, love. It is like an inherent human like longing and craving. We need it. We're sustained by it. And I'm examining how beauty went from that to this very narrow, one-dimensional physical ideal that we worship it as today. And through tracing the history of that change, I'm examining how has that affected us as human beings? How has it affected us physically? How has it affected us psychologically? How has it affected us spiritually? I mean, it's a huge it's a huge topic. I worry I won't be able to do it justice, but it'll be my first attempt at that exploration, because I don't think it's something that's really being addressed right now. Maybe because it's almost impossible to address in its scope. But I'd like to try.
That sounds great. Maybe it'll require a couple editions, not just one book, but a few. Yeah. All right, Jessica, that was so great. Thank you for your time. It was really wonderful to talk with you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I love your questions.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad. I'm glad that I could, I'm just glad that I got to ask them of you. One last one. As I said, this is a book podcast. Is there anything that you've read recently that you really loved? It can be in relation to beauty, or it can just be something that you've really admired and would recommend.
Ooh, okay. Let's see. The last book I finished is called The Book of Ayn, by Lexi Freeman. It's a fiction book. Very funny. Loved it. And then I just finished Disobedient Bodies by Emma Dabiri. Which is a beauty book that I would highly recommend.
I've heard of that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a valuable read for anybody who's interested in beauty culture.
Very cool. Great. And with that, I'm going to let you go. Jessica, thank you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate this.
Welcome to the bookend, where we end with books. So what did you want to talk about with words? Because I also, my notes are full of ideas to that effect.
Okay, so I said up at the top, I alluded to how I like how Jessica gives a lot of thought to what we call things. And the thing that stuck out for me, there are a couple of them, but what was really powerful for me was this idea of renaming the beauty industry to the appearance industry. Because she was like, look, if you lift up the hood, beauty functions as a stand-in for so many different things, like worth, value, power, attraction, desire. That is a lot of values wrapped up in one word. And when you say beauty industry, you're also invoking all of those other feelings, when really all the beauty industry is catering to, or should be catering to, is appearance, not worth, not value, not power, attraction, or desire, just what something looks like. I thought that was really powerful. And I've been thinking about, like when I go into a supermarket and I see beauty products or beauty aisle, or I think about in the US when it says like beauty care or, you know what I'm talking about, right? Mm-hmm. Like in CVS, I just think, what if that were called appearance instead?
It would be empty.
Or would it be more full, you know? I don't know. What did you think about this?
100%. That's what I remembered, what caught my ear, what I wanted to write down. The words we use, what words mean, and also our self-talk. Like this idea of aging gracefully actually means anti-aging.
Yeah.
Or appearing effortless requires a great amount of effort.
Always does.
Yeah, that's what stuck with me. Like you said, beauty is kind of a judgment. It's not even something you can just have. You can't buy it. And when she said the different skin types. And she's like, there's normal. And then there's oily, and then there's dry.
Yeah. And if your skin is functioning normally, it will be all of these things at some point. But for beauty culture, for the beauty industry, normal skin is perfect skin.
Right.
And that's what's kind of dangerous about this. It's that we're all sort of trained toward perfect as being normal. Much like when we talk about, I think I even mentioned it in the interview, the myth of normal, this the Mate book about how labeling something sort that is sort of the average or the idealized average, normal is really dangerous for all of the things around it that fall outside of that scope even slightly.
Yeah, I mean, I want to get to books because the book that I have is called Chatter by Ethan Cross, who's a professor at the University of Michigan in the psychology department. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the idea is that where do these inner voices come from? We all have them. Mm-hmm. Actually, evolutionarily, they facilitate introspection. Fantastic. We like our inner voices. But the problem is that too much inner voice, like, you know, for example, self-criticism or constantly hearing like, oh, my skin's too oily, or oh, I should do this, or is bad. That can lead to, you know, all kinds of negative feelings and distraction that can get in the way. So the way to turn it down is actually to get distance. So you can change the wording, or you can picture somebody else saying it, or you can picture somebody else going through it or doing it. You can address yourself as if you're someone else. So creating some distance. Mm-hmm. And I really feel like that's something that Dafina was talking about. Like, if you take a step back and you look at the messaging and you look at what anti-aging means, or you look at what perfect skin is supposed to mean doesn't make any sense. Like skin acts a certain way. So what we're asking is something that's not natural. We're just asking for something that this product can provide. I mean, Chatter obviously goes into, it's not about skincare per se, but, or about beauty per se.
Yeah.
But I like this idea of being aware of this chatter, understanding where it comes from and having some tools to not let it dominate.
Cool. Good rec.
Yeah. What's your book?
My book is, it's called Happy Fat by Sophie Hagen, who is a comedian and a fat activist. Jessica drew a lot of parallels in this interview between beauty culture and diet culture. She calls beauty culture dewy diet culture, which I think is really pretty accurate. And Sophie Hagen, she's a fat activist, and she really draws a distinction between being fat and being unhealthy, and how fat phobia, not fatness itself, is actually the problem that we should be working on as a society. And she dives into how dieting isn't really all that effective except to make the weight loss industry richer, right? Much like, you know, mascara and anti-aging tools aren't that effective except to make the beauty industry richer. And it's also really funny because, like I said, she's a comedian. So yeah, that's a good one to check out.
Nice.
Then I guess that brings us to the end of the bookend, Ben.
I also very much like this interview, and I think we should pay attention to what words mean. That's not a crazy actionable takeaway, but what does it actually mean when somebody says normal skin or this, you know?
Or regular body type.
Regular body type. Or, I don't know, we've talked so much about this in recent episodes. It's kind of we always have these little mini trends.
Threads, yeah.
Yeah.
And I still don't know if it's like us making them or if it just like happens in the cultural zeitgeist. I don't know how these things bubble up, but they do.
It's funny.
Yeah. All right, then, that's it. Simplify is produced by me, Caitlin Schiller, Ben Schumann-Stoller, Maria Levichik, and Stefan Obadia here in Berlin, Germany at Blinkist HQ. If you would like to try Blinkist, which you should, it is an app that summarizes really great nonfiction books. We also have guides in there that take you through all kinds of different life skills that you might want to develop. We have other cool content inside. You can go to Blinkist.com/friends and enter the code BEAUTY. And I think that for now, that's us checking out.
See you in a couple weeks.
Bye.